Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to the 378th edition of the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. I'll give you an American perspective of our clubs, leagues, players, national team, and other fabulous moments. You can get your daily reading from me and other writers over at onceametro.com and the rest of the SB Nation family of websites. Come on in. Chat room is open. You can discuss with me if you like, or just talk amongst yourselves if you like. If you have any questions, I'll try to answer to the best of my abilities. The World Cup is going on right now. The World Cup is looking pretty solid so far. A lot of surprising results that we're seeing. Very surprised about Argentina so far and Brazil. They ended up in draws. We saw a great match, of course, with Spain and Portugal. Cristiano Ronaldo scored all three goals for Portugal to make it 3-3, of course, with a free kick beauty when Portugal was down 3-2. So we are seeing some great moments in this World Cup. It's not that we never thought we'd see any great moments. We are seeing great moments. All World Cups have their own special place in everyone's heart, depending on who's playing and where it's playing. And what we are watching is pretty cool. And now it's time to have thoughts of my own on the World Cup that was just awarded to the United States, Canada, Mexico, the North America World Cup bid that will be here in 8 years' time. And we got plenty of time for that. We can finally say that we're going to see another World Cup in this country, in this region. I'm very grateful that the United States did ask both Canada and Mexico to be joined in this historical occasion for this World Cup bid that was won. And let's be honest with ourselves here. There should have been no doubt whatsoever that the United States was not going to win this bid, even though Morocco came in late to the party and they proved to have a solid bid, but it just wasn't solid enough. And all you can say is that, you know, give credit to the Moroccan FA. Give them credit for making it interesting at the back end of this bid process. All you can do is go out there and hope you get the winning bid. Now, let me just say this. And once again, this would not have happened. Definitely would not have happened if the United States would have won the bid in 2022. Former President Sepp Blatter, behind this whole mess, put his own ideas ahead of what should have happened. And that is awarding the United States the World Cup in 2022. It should have been 4 years later, not 8 years. Because of the shenanigans being pulled by Sepp Blatter, and how dare he come to the World Cup in Russia, that fraud, that thief. And, oh, the poor man, so upset because the FBI and the U.S. government, a tip that there were shenanigans happening in this World Cup bid for 2022. I have said many, many times, and I've said this repeatedly many, many times, I'm not against an Arab nation to host a World Cup. In fact, I welcome them to host a World Cup. But once again, I believe that if an Arab nation is going to host the World Cup, and we all know the temperatures in those nations in the World Cup, the temperatures are extremely and difficultly hot, extremely hot temperatures in the middle of the day. There's no way you're going to have a World Cup match in the middle of a day. I believe that these nations should be able, because they have the money, they truly have the money, to go out and build these stadiums that should be A, covered with a retractable roof. It's really not that difficult to do this. It's not that difficult to get together, go out, build the damn thing, and then just sit back and have a World Cup. Why do you think they were forced to do it in the wintertime? Why do you think the European leagues are not happy that this is happening? But once again, Sepp Blatter, the shenanigans of keeping his power as president of FIFA, it went too far. Absolutely went too far. But now all of that is gone. Now we have a World Cup here in North America. In 1994, I was 21 years old. I was down in Florida working in Walt Disney World before I even started this whole situation. Because of the 94 World Cup, I got back into the game after the original NASL disappeared. Coming back and seeing a second World Cup now finally coming, I will be 53 years old, I believe. I will be 53 years old. That's amazing. And while there is a lot to plan for and a lot of cities to, you know, go through, you know, within Mexico, within Canada, and of course the United States, I can finally say, I can finally say this. I can say that, you know, I'm excited to see the World Cup back in this part of the world. We are witnessing something very special. Something very, very special. Because to finally have a World Cup back here since 1994. I will say this right now. We deserve it. I truly believe that we deserve to have a World Cup here. Because we've done so well up to the point of not qualifying for this World Cup. I think we've done well with our leagues. I know we still have an issue with the NASL situation, and hopefully the NASL will come back. I want the NASL to come back. The game has grown to a point where it's sustainable enough. There are still issues with our game. There's no doubt about it. They are well documented on social media. I have said as well that we are doing better, but there are still issues that need to be discussed and need to be fixed. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, those issues, it's not just promotion relegation that will fix these issues. We need to have everybody on board to fix these issues so that Pro Rel can thrive and not be a hindrance. But I believe we deserve a World Cup. I truly believe we deserve to host the World Cup. And we're getting it. There will always be those detractors internally that says, no, we don't deserve a World Cup. We should not have a World Cup here, blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And I will tell you right now, I vehemently disagree. We need to have a second World Cup here. We need to have another World Cup here. And until we get to the point where we are satisfied enough to get another World Cup on American soil, North American soil, it will be worth the time. Because I don't mind seeing other nations getting it for the first time ever, if, as long as it's a legitimate vote. That is why I am still upset with this voting that happened for 2018 and 2022. Because Sepp Blatter rushed it in his big plan to keep his power. And that is where I am sorry. So all I can say is, this. Bring on the World Cup in 8 years' time. Bring on the World Cup. Let the world come to the United States. And you know what? We got this vote in spite of the issues that the President of the United States has been doing. And I understand everyone is basically upset politically on what the President has done. But the point is this. This is a sporting matter. This is not a political matter. It's a sporting matter. I would like to see everybody separate politics and sports. I'm not saying to discuss your political beliefs. I'm talking about, let's take a break from those political beliefs and enjoy what we want to do on our free time and our spare time. Take a break from the daily political bashing and the political fodder and the political this and the political that. And let's enjoy what we are going to have here. Let's enjoy the day where we can strip off our professional attire, put on our jerseys, put on our kits, put on our normal clothes, head to the football stadiums, head over to the sporting events, and just take it easy. All I've ever asked for. We can take it easy. We can definitely have some fun. It doesn't have to be political 24/7. That's all I ask. So once again, let's not rush to these conclusions. Let's not hope and pray that certain things are going to be, put up to a point where, you know, we're going to have to discuss what's going on in the country. Let's enjoy ourselves for once, because I think sometimes that's what's missing. And sometimes we need that to just sit back, relax, wind down, and have some fun. And that's what this World Cup is going to be about in 8 years' time. We're going to have some fun. We're not going to skip 2022 because we need to see what our young kids can do in 2022 if they're going to qualify for that World Cup, and we'll see what will happen during that stage. So let's get ready and have some fun. Speaking about having fun, we're going to go ahead and get forward here and talk about the topics that you want to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about Patrick Vieira, of course. He is no longer the head coach of New York City FC. He has moved on to OGC Nice in Ligue 1. Joining me right now, the two gentlemen that have are covering and calling games on New York City FC. First things first, of course, Glenn Crooks broadcasting New York City FC matches for WNYE. And, of course, Blue City Radio, Michael Lander, they both join me tonight. Gentlemen, welcome. I know it's a big World Cup year so far. Unfortunately, our USA team is not in it, but still, you know, Glenn, to talk about the job that Patrick Vieira has done in such a short period of time in MLS, no wonder OGC Nice looked at him, scouted him, watched him, what he was able to do. Great moment for MLS, obviously, to see Vieira leaving for Nice, but obviously it's a little bit tough to see him go in the middle of the league season.
Yeah, and Daniel, how you doing? Good to talk to you. Yeah, there certainly has been some mixed opinion about it. You know, there's a faction of both supporters and media that felt like it was inappropriate of him to leave at this juncture of the season. I don't really see it that way because it's a profession. And I think more than anything, we have to understand Patrick Vieira's background. And I think what happened here is he was given a chance to go home, into a league that will help promote him to the next level, which will be a big club in Europe someday. So, you know, he played, he's discovered by Arsene Wenger when he was 18 years old and even younger, because Wenger coached the Monaco. Patrick Vieira was playing for Cannes, so in Ligue 1. So Wenger noticed Vieira. From that time on, he was thinking about him. And then, as the story goes, they sat in the stands together at the San Siro because Wenger was in between jobs and Vieira wasn't making the 18 for AC Milan, who had signed him at 19. And so he's sitting in the stands, and they got to know each other even better there. And the rest is history for him getting into Arsenal. He's going home, and he's going to a beautiful area of the world. He's going to a club that has ownership that will spend money. And they're, only a point out of a Europa League playoff. So, there's a lot there where he can put his stamp on that program as well. But I think you're right. I mean, he did a lot for New York City FC. There's little question about it in what was a pretty short amount of time. It had to do with his principles, and it had to do with the players that he and David Lee and Claudio Reyna and all those scouts that were involved in finding them. They did a pretty good job of bringing in guys that really fit into the way he wanted to play.
No, I agree with you there. And the one thing I have to say here, Glenn, that really I was amazed with Vieira, whenever, whether it was Yes Network or ESPN or Fox Sports 1, the way he gave out his instructions to the players, the way that he made them feel, not just as a player, but kind of like his neighbor, if you really think about it that way, how his calmness, his easiness to give out instructions to these players, and they followed them through like a T, just absolutely wonderful communication with his players to attack the game plan.
Yeah, his communication was key, but he learned along the way. I think he learned one thing this year. I think he learned that he has to be a little bit more hard on them in certain situations in training, especially off the fact that they've conceded so many headball goals this year. That really disturbed him, and I think it's an area where they didn't maybe focus on that in training to the extent that they could have, because that's something, I just – look, there's different things you could do for training those things. The best thing to do is to battle. Set up situations in training where you're going up in the air and battling. You can talk about the zonal defending off the corner. You can talk about this and that, and you do have to work on those things. But generally speaking, defending those balls in the air is a mentality, and I think that disturbed them the most because Patrick was a player with mentality and I think he was being a little bit hard on himself too, because I think he felt that they weren't responding to the way he was talking about it during the week. So where that would have gone, I'm not sure. I know he upped the tempo of training after a particularly poor game this year, the Red Bulls game. And, you know, I think and they responded. And they responded. But, you know, based on your question and what you were saying about communication, it's one of the most important things that led to his success. I'm sure Michael will agree, because I think the key to Patrick Vieira and the reason he's going to have a big job someday is because he knows how to coach the superstars, and he knows how to coach the younger players. And he had a relationship with both. And to be honest, there aren't many coaches that can do that.
No, it's very true. And Michael Lander, of course, from Blue City Radio, is joining me as well. And Michael, you know, from a distance, obviously, you know, whenever you got into the locker room or whenever you get to the press conference room at Yankee Stadium, you know, just for him talking to the media the way he did, you know, a very honest man, a good man that never shied away from his opinions of the match, never shied away his opinions about a player, whether, you know, it's after a match or maybe, you know, during training. You know, what was it about Patrick Vieira that made your life easier whenever you were asking the questions that he was a very, you know, he gave you a very honest opinion of the situation?
Yeah, I think you're right on. I think the part that was the best of working with him was his engagement. And I know Glenn's had a lot more conversations with Vieira, seeing that he traveled with the team on the road on almost basically every game. But Vieira was not only a guy who knew so much about the sport. He loved to talk about it, loved to communicate about it, but he was also engaging. He was someone who would explain his opinions, and if he thought that you had a point that was different from his, you know, he would ask you to elaborate on it. It wouldn't be just a dismissive response that says, hey, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, he would say, well, tell me why you think that way, or what you think would be a better alternative. So he could you know, enlighten you, or so he could hear your perspective and say, hey, that's not a bad response. That's something I can think about.
Yeah, Patrick
absolutely.
Patrick does not mind criticism as long as you have your own thoughts on it. You know, that's the thing. Because I told him I don't know if Patrick read or listened to anything. I really don't. But if he did, he would see that the people have been critical. I've been critical, whether on the air or in writing. And I spoke to him once about that. And just like Michael said, if you have some reasoning for your criticism, then okay. And you got to remember, this guy played for Arsenal for 9 years in England, where the microscope is only about 2,000 to 3,000 times what it is here in the States. And so he's completely used to, you know, any sort of criticism. It doesn't bother him. It doesn't bother him because he's been through it as a player. It's different as a coach, but the microscope, much larger overseas.
No, absolutely, Glenn. And, you know, once again, that situation is very huge. And, of course, you know, that leads me to basically the day that Arsene Wenger has called it a career as a coach for Arsenal. And already, you know, Michael, the automatically the eyes came over to North America, and everyone already assumed that Vieira was going to be the heir apparent. Of course, some have said Thierry Henry, but, you know, right now he's the assistant coach for Belgium at the World Cup for the national team. But either one of those two, Michael, you know, not saying that Vieira can't do the job, but, you know, when that moment came around, you know, what were your thoughts about Vieira taking over for Wenger?
Well, I think that job might have been a little bit too big. I think the when you look at replacing a legend like Wenger, you know, you could look at the most clear example would be when Alex Ferguson left. Alex Ferguson left Manchester United, and you look at how long it took for them to settle things down there. I don't know that you always want to be the guy after a legend leaves. I think the other part of it that was interesting, because I was there when those rumors came up, and Vieira addressed them pretty quickly in his press conference following that game. The Associated Press actually had a reporter out there to ask him specifically about that, and and he turned that conversation off pretty quickly. But we had to deal with rumors about Everton. We had to deal with a bunch of different rumors, and the Nice rumors were the ones that obviously ended up coming to fruition. But ultimately, if I look back at how Vieira handled those rumors and handled this controversy and handled this this change,
yep.
I don't think Vieira wanted to leave. In the conversations that we've talked, the one comment that I go back to that he shared the first week that the Nice rumors were starting to bubble up was that he said he doesn't control what happens. He can only control how he focuses his energy on the team and on getting NYCFC ready for the next game. And I look at that he yes, it's true, he did deny the rumors that his agent was in conversations with Nice. So maybe that wasn't 100% factual, but the reality of it is, I think he was hopeful that NYCFC and CFG would do what it would take to keep him as part of the family, and unfortunately, I don't think that came to fruition.
Yeah, that's the one thing there, Glenn. Uh-huh.
No, it's I was in a pretty interesting spot. I was on my way to Portland for the New York City Portland games when the story hit that Arsene Wenger was going to pack it in. So I actually had the first interview with Patrick because I was going to training that day, and the New York City communication staff said, look, everybody in the world's calling, but we just want you to do it. We want you to ask three or four questions, and we're just going to keep it at that for now. So I abided by that. We had a good chat about it. The biggest thing that Patrick wanted to do was focus on Arsene and what he did for him. Everyone knows, because he's made it pretty public, that Patrick was disappointed that he never got a call from Arsene Wenger to come over and assist in some capacity on the coaching level at the Arsenal Football Club. That's very disappointing to Patrick. That doesn't mean that there won't be a day he goes back to be the coach, but that stung him a bit. And when you find out later that Arteta was in the same boat, and Henry Winter, esteemed writer for the Times in England, I interviewed him once, and he told me that Arsene Wenger, the reason he didn't want Vieira or Arteta there is because he was threatened by them. And when you see how Wenger operated over the last few years, and this is where I'll disagree a bit with Michael, I think replacing Arsene Wenger at Arsenal is dissimilar than replacing Sir Alex at Manchester United, with Man United coming off success and Arsenal, you know, really, I don't know how many years it has been where they've underachieved as far as what the expectation was. So I think Vieira, and I'll never forget Patrick in a little media scrum on the day they opened up the New York City FC training facility. It was Ivis Galarsip was kind of talking around it, you know, and about, and Patrick just interrupted him and said, look, if you're asking if I'm ready, I'm ready. So Patrick felt very strongly that he's prepared to take whatever job was offered him out there. And if Arsenal pulled the Rooney rule on him, if that is indeed true, because he did talk to them once, he accepted a phone call, but he wouldn't go any further with it. But the Rooney rule being that, you know, you have to interview a minority candidate for any position like a head coach or sporting director, things like that. If Arsenal pulled that on him, and then after what Arsene Wenger did to him, never bringing him on staff, that may sit with him for a while.
Yeah. No, I agree with you completely. But once again, though, if I can, Michael, to Vieira, you know, the two and a half years that – you know, he managed New York City FC, Michael, was just phenomenal what they do. You know, occasionally, I mean, I would look at some of the matches on YES or on ESPN or Fox Sports 1. I mean, the way that they played with the ball, and, of course, at times when they played without the ball, I thought New York City FC, you know, seamless transition with the players he brought over, you know, seeing what Villa did with, you know, players like Sweat, Matarilla, Yangel Herrera, just to see him get these players to play as a cohesive unit was just wonderful to watch. And to see them doing what they are able to do in the regular season, and you wondered sometimes, you know, a match here, a match there, you know, maybe a little out of sync, which, you know, it happens in every club. You'll get one of those stinkers, obviously. You know, they're not immune to that. But still, I thought that, for the most part, Vieira got them to become one nice cohesive unit.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think the way he did that was because he was able to focus on the idea that nothing is taken for granted. And you heard it from player after player. They had to make the most of the opportunities when they were given to them, whether they were players like Mikey Lopez or a player like Andrea Pirlo. And they also had to realize that that they weren't guaranteed anything. And we saw that with how Vieira handled Pirlo last year. And we've seen it a little bit this year, whether it be David Villa nursing injury or trying to be rested. You know, we saw that crazy week where they had to play the three games in the week, and Villa, you know, didn't start a couple of those games just to make sure that he was fit, and Vieira could use him when he felt he needed him the most. So I think that's what Vieira did. Was part of it was the way he, like we talked about earlier, the way he communicated his desires and his vision for the team. But then the other of it was the way he made his decisions, and everyone realized there's no guarantees.
Glenn, I want to throw this at you because, you know, you being a former head coach, whether it's for the men's game or the women's game, I mean, I think you could speak out about this because about 3 years ago, obviously, we're going to talk about those games against the Red Bulls, especially the first game in 2016 where, yes, the Red Bulls did score 7 goals at Yankee Stadium that one afternoon in May or June. I think it was in May. Yes, it was 7-0. But I'm seeing the response he gave to the media. He laughed it off. You can tell he laughed it off because, you know, this is never going to happen again to me. You know, I have a lot of more work to do and everything is fine. And then you fast forward to the first match at Red Bull Arena in league play where they gave up 3 goals in the first half. It ended with a 4-0 scoreline at Red Bull Arena. Then you saw the frustration out of Vieira. Then you saw what he didn't like, what he was opposed to, why he didn't like what he saw from his players because they were either not ready to perform or they assumed that they were going to walk in and they're going to get 3 points or at least take any form of points for that first league match of this year in the Derby. You know, that's the one thing I respect out of Patrick Vieira because he was just a brand new head coach then when it was 7-0. But this time around, no, he wasn't happy from what he got from his players when it was 4-0.
Well, I'll tell you right now, he was not happy with 7-0. And, you know, in public he may have, you know, tried to just ward it off with humor, but that's internally, that was not what was going on. But the thing that Patrick, I think, and he's not alone in this as a coach, but he learns from anything that he deems a mistake. He learns from it. This guy is really educated in the game. Whenever he has a moment, he will go observe someone else train. He takes time and he'll find a program where he likes the way they play. So he'll go and spend a week with a coach if he gets permission just to see how they operate. I mean, he did it with Sevilla. He did it with Napoli. Just, you know, things that he would observe and really like. He did it with Chile. So there's a big part of Patrick here. And one of the reasons, and Michael talked about how I got to get to go on the road and I'd have coffees with him. And the reason Patrick and I got along so well, I think more than anything, is because he's almost all he wants to do is talk football. And once you start getting involved and moving the salt and pepper shakers around a little bit and doing that sort of thing, you know, he'll always engage in a discussion of soccer. And the most fun I ever had with him was on a plane ride home from Toronto, you know, one of those small planes, and it just by chance I was sitting next to him. And what's really interesting is that it was the preceding that 7-0 game at Yankee Stadium. It was a trip home. They had that Heineken rivalry week. And they'd had a really exhausting schedule at Portland, at Toronto, and then coming back and having to play the Red Bulls three matches in 8 days. And then they had to do this press conference when they landed in New York City, and he didn't like that because it was taken away for the preparation. But I sat with him with he had his computer open, and he was watching the Red Bulls, and I was kind of – I really wanted to, like, watch and ask him about a few things, and he let me. So for, like, an hour, we were talking about things we were observing, and he'd say, "What do you see here?" And I was like, "Oh, my God." So I was – for me, that was having to have a 45-minute to hour tactical session with Patrick Vieira.
No, I think Glenn, I think – you know, you as a former coach, I think he welcomed your opinions, obviously, because he can talk shop with you. And I think that's fantastic, especially a man like Vieira, his stature as a footballer, what he has done as a manager right now. You know, Glenn, I think for you, I think that's just absolutely fantastic. And I think you should really, I mean, I know you have, but I in my opinion, I think you should be really excited to have a conversation with him. Now, whether you're going to Nice on vacation when the season's over, maybe he'll let you in for a training session here or there. I mean, I think that'd be the ultimate greatness right there. If, you know, he calls you up and Glenn to say, "Would you like to come to Nice to watch me watch training for a while?" I think that'd be great for you.
Dan, when you started all that, I thought you said, "Glenn, you should be a coach in MLS." Didn't you think that, Michael? Didn't you think it was going that way? That's where I thought you were going. But anyway.
Wait, and Orlando hasn't called you yet?
Not yet. Well, you know, you bring up Jason Kreiss, who I also, you know, I also became close to in a different way because Jason didn't let you in the same way that Patrick did. And, you know, I'm not going to be critical of that. But if you compare the two, Jason did not want to talk tactics. He just did. I think in some way, just, you know, it was almost like, "Why am I talking tactics with you?" And I was never insulted by that because I think everybody should handle their situations whichever way they feel comfortable. Maybe, you know, maybe across the years, Jason was, you know, he was, something happened in the media where, he got screwed somehow, you know, like, information got out. Who knows, you know, but he wasn't as open, but that wasn't his personality either. I'm sorry for what happened, you know, at Orlando City, but I think, I think the fact that he's, I think you'd have to say failed in these next two jobs after RSL, he's got to really take a close look at himself and how, and this is what you have to do. And I know he did. After he got fired by NYCFC, although he didn't agree with the firing, I remember the one thing, I went down the very first game that those two played against each other, New York City and Orlando City. I got a chance to go down to Orlando City's practice, and I knew Miles Joseph pretty well too. And I asked him, I said, "Well, what is it that you took away that you maybe you can, you know?" Because remember, he took that in the middle of the summer. And he said, "The biggest thing is I need to organize these guys defensively. And I never did that the way I should have at New York City FC." So this is good. And this is what coaches have to do. But, you know, the legacy of Patrick, I think, more than anything else, is that he brought his principles. He stuck with them. But he made adjustments along the way because he was still a coach in training. He'll always be a coach in training because if you're a good coach, if you're a great coach, you're always learning. And he's left a good program here. And this next guy coming in may have the best pedigree of an assistant coach I have ever seen, but he hasn't managed a club very often, so that's always different than being an assistant. But 24 trophies in 11 years with Pep Guardiola is that's not bad.
No, it really isn't. And yes, Michael, when will you be invited to Nice training by Patrick Vieira? No, I'm just joking.
I'm going. Even if I don't get invited, I'm going.
Dan, as you were leading into the conversation, you were talking about the U.S. Men's National Team and obviously Qatar, and then United 2026 coming up after that. And I think the other part of it, talking about Vieira's legacy, it ties in very well with something that Claudio Reyna said at the last training session for NYCFC. you know, the fact that there shouldn't be restrictions or rules placed on American players getting talent, that everything had to be earned. And I think that goes back to what I was talking about earlier with Vieira and saying nothing was for granted, or nothing was, you know, none of these players could take their minutes for granted, because that's what I think is going to help the U.S. When they need to develop the best talents to put on the field, both the next World Cup and the one after that, is making sure that these players are going out there and earning their opportunities. So whether that's Josh Sargent going to Werder Bremen, whether it's the rumors about Gio Reyna going over to Dortmund, these guys have to take the most of their opportunity, and they can't just sit back and say, hey, I'm going to play for an MLS Academy team. I'm going to get drafted as, or taken up as a homegrown player, and they're going to give me minutes because they have to, because I'm American. These guys have to go out there and constantly challenge themselves.
Yeah, let me throw this at you guys real quick. Obviously, he's going to Nice right now. He's already there, and you know, obviously, big moment for him to be back from his country of birth, obviously. But let me throw this out at you guys, and Michael, I'm going to let you answer that first, and then I'll go to Glenn. If, let's just say, he's there for a couple of years, I don't know, five years, maybe 7 years, we don't know the life span of these managers in Europe, obviously. One day you're there, you're supposed to be there for 10, 5, 15 years, the next minute you're done managing the team that you signed with, and you're going to either another club or a national team. I don't want to talk about the guy from Spain who basically dumps the federation to go to Real Madrid, but do you think, gentlemen, that the next step is Arsenal when he's done with Nice, or do you think maybe he'll go and join, he'll manage the national team, whether it's France or maybe another country? We'll go with Michael first and then Glenn.
You know what, I think the best way I could answer it is that the decision is ultimately going to be in Vieira's hands. I think he's proven with NYCFC that he can do what it takes to prove his worth. He can take a challenge, and he can think long scale through it. He didn't come in. Yes, he achieved some results in his first year. He did it with a roster that he partially inherited, and you could see the progression from year after year. And I think that's even with people being frustrated with how 2018 has been, it's still a progression and a better record through 15 games than it was in 2017. So I think ultimately it's going to be his choice, that he's not going to be someone I see getting kicked out of a lot of places. I think it's going to be more, it's going to be a question of whether Arsenal is the ones that call him up next, or is there going to be a bigger fish that's going to be offered to him.
Well, go ahead, Glenn.
I think a national team position is in the future for Patrick Vieira, but not for some time. I think he's a club coach. You know, it's two different animals. He loves the day-to-day environment, the planning. I don't think right now, at the age of 41 and a young first-team manager, that's not something he's going to consider. I mean, he laughed when his name was mentioned as a possible U.S. men's national team coach. You know, that came out, so we asked him one day at training, you know, I don't exactly remember when, last season, tail end of last season, and he was just like, that's not for me. That's not the right job for me. And a big part of the reason why is he likes the club level. So you're not going to see will he coach the French national team someday? I think he absolutely will. That'll be his national team job, and he'll get a big-time European club job first. And, you know, maybe 55 years old, a little after that, maybe that's when he moves into the national team picture, something like that. And Daniel, I want you to give me a list of the managers that have coached for 15 years in Europe. I don't know, in your intro there, you were talking about, you know, they signed for 10, 15 years. It's 1, 2. I mean, I don't know what I know this is not the Premiership. It's the Championship right under it. But I couldn't believe this because I never thought of it this way. Statistically, managers last 9 months in the Championship. 9 months!
So I'm sure it's,
yeah,
you know, pretty close to that, you know, worldwide in all the different divisions. It's a crazy coaching world out there.
No, it really is. And I can definitely, you know, in the Premier League, it's definitely Wenger and Sir Alex Ferguson that comes to mind. I don't know how long Mourinho was manager for Chelsea, gentlemen, but obviously I would have to assume it's either before the nine or just after it. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. But listen, guys, I appreciate your time. Thanks for talking about Patrick Vieira. Now, I wish him nothing but the best of luck at Nice. And we'll see what the new guy can do once he comes over for NYCFC. Thank you very much, Glenn, and thank you very much, Michael. You have a good evening. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you, Daniel. Really have a good one.
All right, you too. And once again, that was Glenn Crooks broadcasting for WNYE, New York City FC broadcaster, Michael Anderer, Blue City Radio on the podcast. Joining me right now, a very happy man. Of course, SoccerChronicles.com, the Cantina MX podcast, the one and only John Jagu, Mexico defeating Germany 1-0. And then, of course, Mexico, part of the North American tri-bid with Canada, United States, wanted to get his thoughts as well on the Mexican side of things. John, good evening. How are you? And the party is still going on by Casa Jagu? Still going?
Hey, Daniel.
You still playing the loud music?
It's not, the party isn't going on, but I still can't believe it happened.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, and it's so weird because, I mean, you don't think that, you know, I mean, Mexico has been playing and playing well in World Cups, you know, for the better part of the last 30 years. But they've, I mean, even before then just had never gotten a win. This, you know, I don't even call it, I mean, it's a group stage win, and I get that. But still, I mean they've never beaten they've never beaten Germany before ever, and you know, at least not in an official competition. And they've never really, you know, and certainly not in the World Cup. And it was just, you know, and it wasn't necessarily, you know, it was, you know, a game where like they got like a lucky goal or a lucky bounce or an own goal or a, you know, a set, you know, whatever it was. I mean, it was a game where Mexico, I thought, could have probably, you know, and maybe should have won, you know, 2-0, maybe even 3-0. I mean, they played really well. And it was a stunner. I mean, I was, you know, and I wrote before the game that, you know, to me the, you know, obviously it would be great. You know, I was like, you know, the dream was this to win. You know, if you get a draw, that's fantastic. And but if you're going to lose, don't lose by more than two. And I thought for sure that they would end up losing the game, but keep the damage to a minimum and maybe just only lose by a couple of goals and. You know, and then make up the difference against Sweden and South Korea to see if they could advance out of the group with Germany. But now it's you know things are obviously different. I'm stunned by the way that not only did Osorio prepare the team, but the way Mexico played. I mean, they played just an outstanding match of 90 minutes at both ends of the field. You know, could they have scored a few more? Sure, but you know that's soccer. I mean, soccer is not a you know, it's a very imprecise sport. It's not, you know, it's not like handball where you're going to have games that are 15-14. I mean, you have to, you know, make the most of your opportunities that Mexico had. A couple of them, they didn't make the most of them, but they made the most out of the one when they got the goal, and they were able to make it stand. And that, you know, that's, you know, almost, you know, equally as important as scoring is making sure that your other team doesn't score, especially when you have such a slim lead. And Mexico was able to do that, and you know, again, you know, for all 11 guys to have as good a game as they did, it really was just amazing. And you know, I think that you know, Juan Carlos Osorio has had to deal with a lot of crap from the particularly the Mexican media. I think more so than the international media for how he's managed Mexico over these past few years, and. You know, and the way that he prepares for things, and you've seen it, Daniel, because I know that you've met him and you talked to him. I mean, he's a very diligent guy, and you know, the World Cup was, you know, he even said, you know, this is the most important game of my career, you know, the game against Germany, and you know, for a guy who is known for you know, thinking things and overthinking things and preparing and overpreparing, I mean, he really had Germany down cold, you know, down to who was going to be their last sub. And you know he was prepared for that. I mean, he was prepared for how Germany was going to play. He was prepared for how they were going to, you know, what they were going to do to make Germany uncomfortable. He was prepared for what Mexico was not going to do to give Germany the advantages like they did last summer in the Confederations Cup, which you know, I think, you know, in the long run ended up being an absolute you know, an incredible blueprint for Mexico to help them understand you know, how, you know, a team can beat a team like Germany, which is exactly what, you know, it was exactly what they used. They said that they could not allow Germany to have as much space as they did in the Confed Cup, and they said that they had to constantly, not necessarily pressure, but just make them uncomfortable. Like they couldn't have them, you know, particularly Toni Kroos and Hummels and Mesut Ozil, they couldn't have them be comfortable on the ball. They just, and it wasn't necessarily pressuring them. It was just marking them. It was just being in front of them. You know, don't give them, make them get rid of the ball where they don't want to get, you know, when they don't want to get rid of it and where they don't want to pass it to. And it ended up working extremely well. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, everyone played their first match of the World Cup. I mean, outside of maybe Spain, can you think of any other side that looked as good as Mexico did? And you know, after their first match, I mean, I'm not saying that because I'm a Mexico fan. I mean, I'm saying that, I mean, I've watched every game and I'm thinking,
mm-hmm.
You know, Mexico, you know, to me, had far and away the most impressive performance.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, if you're talking about, you know, I mean, outside of Europe, I would say no. Maybe, I don't know, maybe Senegal a little bit against Poland, you might think, even though Poland is always one of those opponents where they're kind of, depending on which game you get, are they going to be that good, they're going to be that bad. So,
right.
I mean, I think Senegal probably would have had – I think today Senegal had a very good match. I think they looked pretty solid. But once again, when a guy reenters the match and then all of a sudden he's in a position to attack all of a sudden, and that – I just think that shouldn't have been – that goal should never have counted.
Yeah,
but that's
well, don't forget, Daniel, that he entered the match when Poland had possession, and it was a Polish guy that passed it back to his goalkeeper. So – I know there's a lot of hand-wringing about that,
okay.
But the guy was already on it. It wasn't like he was running on the pitch. He'd been on the pitch for a while. So let's not pretend that was a Senegal pass. That was a Polish back pass to a guy who got caught sleeping. So
that's true.
Yeah,
true. No, that's true, yeah. No, absolutely. I agree with you there. But I have to say, though, Irving Lozano, who plays for PSV Eindhoven in the Dutch Eredivisie, were you shocked he went short side? Because I thought he might go for the far post, but he went short side to the near where the keeper was, you know, hugging the near post almost, and he missed it too.
You know, I always feel like in a situation like that it's better to go near side because that's where the goalie's not expecting it. And I think he also kind of had to because of the because I think it was Hummels, I think that was closing in on him pretty good. He had already gotten by Ozil, so I know that he had to, you know, get it in. Yeah, and it was, you know, and just that play right there, I mean, you know, that to me was so emblematic of what it was that Osorio did so differently, you know, in this game than he had done in previous ones was, and a goal where, you know, at least, you know, as a Mexico fan, I've been calling for years, you know, you have unbelievable speed and skill on the outside, and you have guys that can get on the, you know, by all means, you know, set those counters. And in reading a tactical review of actually from a German magazine today, the writer said that the player that he considered the MVP of the game wasn't Herrera, who was outstanding, or even Lozano, the goal scorer. He said it was Javier Hernandez, because what he did throughout the entire match was play himself in an onside position so that the defenders would ignore him until Mexico got the ball. And the minute they got the ball, he would jump back on, you know, he would jump onside, and then he would be in perfect position to cause a lot of damage. And, you know, he was the one that set up Lozano. He was the one that set up a couple other guys, too. I mean, he had an outstanding game. And, for people that, you know, I know people like to give Chicharito a lot of, you know, flack for whatever reason. I've never quite really understood it. But, you know, he's – where he goes, he had two guys following him everywhere he went. So he was opening up just huge chunks of space for the midfielders or for the other wingers, you know, whatever it was. I mean, he may not have had the best season at West Ham United, but you better believe that other teams understand and respect, you know, what it is that he can do. And he was able to, without the ball, have as much influence on a game as any player with it. And it was just he was even the one that said that my job defensively was to make sure that Hummels did not bring the ball up, because we wanted to make him as uncomfortable as possible too, so they'd give it to Boateng. And Boateng, again, great player, but not necessarily the one that you want you know, conducting traffic for the German attack, which is what ended up happening for good parts of the game. So just an absolutely brilliant game plan by Osorio and flawless execution by the Mexican side. Now, they had to hang on, as one would expect against, you know, I mean, it's still Germany. And but I don't, I mean, I really don't think that, you know, I know that, that Ochoa ended up having like 8 or 9 saves, but I mean, you really, outside of a couple, I mean, there were really no just absolutely, you know, slam dunk German chances that you think, oh, wow, that was an incredible, you know, like the Brazil game in the 2014 World Cup. I mean, they kept Germany, and Germany did get their shots off, don't get me wrong. And they're still, you know, I feel bad for Sweden because I have a feeling that the Germans are going to come out with a little more anger and conviction in that game. But, you know, I just think that Mexico played an outstanding game. And if this is and but again, I think that for all Mexico fans and me included, that, you know, it doesn't do you any good to beat Germany and then not qualify out of the group stage. So they, you know, there's, you know, but the Germany game, Mac Brown used to do this great thing whenever he'd have a big win like that, especially if it like made like a cover of a magazine or whatever it is that he would go with his team and he would bury it. He would bury the magazine or he'd bury the newspaper or whatever it was. They would bury, all right, let's move on because we got another one next week, so that they would, you know, move on to the next one and not dwell over, you know, what just happened. And that was that was actually the message from the players even after the game, is that, hey, yes, it's a big game. We, you know, we're very excited. We celebrated. But that's that. It's over and done with. We got two other games that we got to take care of. And, again, you know, I think back, Daniel, at that recent World Cup history, Switzerland beat Spain in the 2010 World Cup to open the group stage. Spain obviously goes on to win the World Cup. Switzerland does not even make it out of the group stage, so they were eliminated. So the beating Spain did them no favors. Germany has lost in the group stage twice since 1974, actually 1978, once to Algeria in the opening match in 1982, and then again in 2010 to Serbia. Neither Algeria nor Serbia moved out of the group stage. So beating Germany, yes, as it is an absolutely great accomplishment, probably the biggest win in the group stage for sure that Mexico's ever had. I still think that their win over Bulgaria in the round of 16 still counts as the biggest win because it's the only time they've ever won anything outside of the group stage. So that to me is still the biggest one. But it's just a group win. You know, get your 6 points, get your 7 points, whatever it is you need to do to get to advance. And you know, and then go fry your bigger fish. Now, what this does do, however, Daniel, is that it puts Mexico in position to, in theory, if they can win first place in the group, hopefully avoid Brazil and avoid just a lion's den of a bracket. If they're able to go down to the other, you know, the bottom half of that particular bracket. So that's what Mexico, I think, has in front of them now. Is, you know, if they can get a win against South Korea, and then. At that point, they would just need a tie, hopefully against Sweden, to get that first place. And then Brazil, you know, they did Mexico no favors on Sunday after the Mexico game by tying Switzerland. Like, come on, guys, you're supposed to win your group. Don't be tying Switzerland. Don't do that to us. Don't make us win the group and make you guys play because you came in second place. That can't happen. So, you know, by all means.
Yeah.
So that to me, you know, Mexico. If they can, you know, get that first place in the group and then, you know, possibly avoid a round of 16 matchup with Brazil, you know, playing like a Switzerland or a Serbia, even Costa Rica, you know, whoever comes out in second, which, and again, we're making a huge assumption. Then, I mean,
right.
You know, the quarterfinal and the semifinals, I'm not wanting to get ahead of myself, but it is not as, especially the quarters, they're not as, the round of 16 are not as, as dangerous as one would have, you know, having to play, you know, Brazil, and I think after that it's like Belgium or England, you know, just whoever it is. It's
right.
So it is a huge win, but just a group win. Go win. Now you have a chance to go win the group. Go do that, and then we'll see where the chips fall after that.
It should be exciting, and I gotta tell you, John, I think for the first time in a long time, I feel a little more confident in Mexico because, you know, maybe they're going to go further than the round of 16, and they're finally going to maybe take a run, you know, outside the two times that Mexico's hosted the World Cup. So we'll see what they do, you know, in this one. Of course, there's two more group stage matches to go, and we'll see what they'll do. And that leads me to, of course, my next question, John. Obviously, Mexico, Canada, United States, they win the North American tri-bid. to host the World Cup in 8 years' time, 2026. What did you make of it? And, you know, how special will it be for you, not just to see Mexico hosting World Cup matches, but, of course, Canada and the United States, you know, our North American neighbors, obviously, you know, getting out there and in 8 years' time hosting a World Cup that, you know, for the first time ever, three nations will join in a bid to host one of the greatest sporting events the world has ever seen.
Well, you know, the games are going to expand, so we have to remember that. So it's going to be an 80-game tournament. Personally, I would have liked to have seen the split of games a little bit more evenly split. I mean, I understand that the U.S. is going to be the bulk of the bid, and I get that. But there's no reason why Canada or Mexico couldn't have gotten at least the minimum of it. And it could change. I think right now they're standing at, you know, 10 games apiece, and the U.S. gets 60. It seems to me that, you know, if Canada and Mexico could have gotten 15 games and the U.S. gets 50, or even 20 games and the U.S. gets 40, I think that would have, I mean, if you're going to have a true, splitting of hosting duties, I think that would be, that would make a little more sense. Now, I'm a little leery about the bid, and I'm very happy that it happened, and, you know, in 8 years, we'll, you know, it'll be a lot of fun to see the World Cup come back to this part of the world, because it's been since 1994. I'm a little worried about, you know, some of the venues, in the sense that, you know, they have the field turf for football right now. And, you know, we've seen games and Gold Cups and friendlies, et cetera, when they put the fake stuff down and the fields aren't necessarily the best. You know, hopefully they'll get that resolved, you know, and have the fields laid down a little earlier. It's a World Cup. It's going to be great. I mean, I've watched every game of this World Cup. I'll watch every game of the next World Cup. It's what I do. It's my event. I was mm-hmm. lucky enough to go to three games when they had the World Cup in '94 up at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas, and I'm sure that I will do the same again. And a little sad that Vancouver isn't on the list of host cities, although I'm sure that could change as well, because I mean I can't imagine a World Cup in Canada without Vancouver being involved. But obviously, you know, those details can be hammered out over the next 8 years. And honestly, Daniel, what I think that what this will set the tone for, I think that this will set the tone for, especially with these 48-team World Cups, I think that we're going to see moving forward kind of like the Euro 2020, where it's kind of dispersed among a bunch of places. I think that we're going to see that with the World Cup. I think that we'll see Africa get the next World Cup in the sense that it'll be played in Cairo and, you know, in casino, blah, 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 et cetera, so that the countries, you know, don't have to spend the billions of dollars to build, you know, 12 new stadiums. They can just, you know, spend a little and have their one or two really nice stadiums. And then they'll
yeah.
share the hosting duties. I think we'll see that. I think we'll see that in South America. And I think the future of the World Cups are going to be World Cups that are going to be split among three, four, even as many as five countries.
No, I agree there. And I mean, I was talking to someone about, you know what, if the United Kingdom is going to host a World Cup, then, you know, you might as well involve Wales and Ireland, Northern Ireland, Scotland, as well as England. Because I'm telling you right now, John, if we're expecting a five-nation World Cup, the United Kingdom is the perfect place to have that happen.
Sure. I mean, you know, and you can have it. You know, that way you could have it in, you know, in Western Europe, you could have it in Eastern Europe. It was hard enough for Brazil to put on a 32-team World Cup. There's no way they can do a 48-team World Cup. You know, there's no way Morocco could have done a 48-team World Cup. But, you know, you pair Morocco with Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, and some of the other African countries, and they could easily stage, you know, a very nice World Cup. And I think that we'll see that. I know that we'll see the Argentina. I'm sure it'll be like an Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, Chile World Cup coming up, because, you know, the World Cup centennial will be in 2030, and I know that they're hoping to have that in South America. But I don't think that they could have it in just one country. So yeah, I do think that that this is going to set the tone for how World Cups are going to, especially if they have a 48-team. I mean, that's a lot of games, Daniel. That's, you're putting a lot of pressure on a country. I mean, look, I mean, look at how many fans, not necessarily European fans, but how many fans from other countries have invaded Russia for these games. I mean, there were easily 50,000 Mexicans or more in Moscow at the Luzhniki Sunday. Colombia today, I mean, I could not believe how many Colombians were in the stands. I mean, it was like
I know.
Out of the 50,000 or whatever was the capacity, it was easily, you know, 35,000. Peru, I mean, that game to me outside of the Mexico game was the most, the Peru Denmark game was the most entertaining. It was just you know, end to end action, and just, and the crowd, you know, both the Peruvians and the Danes were just such great, you know, such a great crowd, and it was such an emotional game. And you know, Daniel, I've told you before, I mean, I have a soft spot for Peru, and I didn't realize it until today when Leon Kraus, who's the anchor for Univision in Los Angeles, wrote an article about his first memory as a child was watching Mexico just get blasted by Germany 6-0. And I remember that game. And I remember Mexico just having a terrible World Cup. I mean, they lost to Tunisia, and then Germany, they lost to Poland. And they were just awful. They didn't win any games, minus 10 goal differential. Just, you know, it couldn't have gone worse for Mexico. But I remember Peru just in their group stage just smoking people. And I was thinking, man, I wish we could be Peru when I did this. I was like 5 years old. And so and they played so well and so beautifully. I mean, even as a 5-year-old, I could see that. And it made me realize that's why I like Peru, because I remember just being so jealous that Peru was doing so well in the World Cup, and Mexico was just, you know, having their clocks clean. And then of course, you know, Peru fell apart in the next round and gave up a pile of goals against everybody they played and were eliminated. But but it was great to see Peru in the World Cup. And you know, and these countries, you know, that have all these fans, I just don't see how, especially for a 48-team tournament, some of these small countries can handle that kind of influx of folks visiting their countries. So I think we are going to see it dispersed. You know, for an 80-game tournament, I mean, that's, you know, I don't even think the U.S. can handle an 80-game tournament, to be honest. I mean, that's a lot of games.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think that's why, you know, that, you know, I'm glad Mexico has agreed to be a part of the bid, and I'm glad Canada's agreed to be a part of the bid. And here's the funny thing here, John, is that where I'm located in New Jersey right now, in northwestern New Jersey, Parsippany, Hackensack, Bergen County, Essex County, this is the home of the American-Peruvian get-togethers. I mean, I've never, ever seen so many Peruvians living in this part of the New Jersey my entire life. I mean, I always thought, you know,
until this weekend,
all the expats
when you saw the red
from South America are in Florida. Huh?
Until you saw the red sashes on the shirts this weekend?
Exactly. And it's not
yeah,
just
that's
that.
Another reason.
It's like, I get the secret handshake, too.
Yeah, see, and that's another reason why Peru is so great is because you see that shirt and you don't have any doubts what team that is.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, everyone knows that team is Peru. And so I mean, I know it's River Plate also, but for national teams, it is Peru. I mean, you can see a yellow shirt. It could be Brazil. It could be Colombia. It could be one of the African teams.
Mm-hmm.
It could be Sweden. You have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But you see that white shirt
That's
with
right.
that red sash, and there's no doubt in your mind who that team is.
Exactly. And plus, because of the situation with their captain, Guerrero, where he was serving a ban for apparently they said that he ingested tea, that the tea had some sort of chemical in it that I guess was a false positive that said he was doping. And then he got all the evidence to go to the WADA, and they still said, no, we're going to – now that you challenged us, we're going to give you a 10-15-month more ban because you challenged us. And then they had to go to FIFA, and I believe,
it
was ridiculous.
To the legal courts. He went to the legal courts. So I'm not a big fan of WADA, and I'm not saying that I advocate athletes use performance-enhancing drugs or whatever. I just, you know –
Of course.
But whatever. But what I will say is that these guys are professional athletes. These guys make a living by using their bodies. I look at the NFL and I look at a guy like Tony Romo. The last year he played a full season. Tony Romo couldn't practice during the week. He had to have a shot of whatever it was to give him in his back so he could even play. And yet, that's not a performance enhancing drug. but you know, using all these other things are, and you know, it just to me that the whole thing, it's a different topic altogether, but it just reminds me of how, you know, when organized sports started to come about in the early part of the 20th century, and you know, they, you know, had to make sure that everyone had to maintain their amateur status. You know, you couldn't be professional or anything, blah blah blah. The only reason that they did that is because the amateurs were a bunch of rich dudes that didn't want to get shown up by the pros because the pros were 1,000 times better than they were. That's the only reason that they wouldn't allow professionals, is because they didn't want to, because they were a bunch of, you know, rich little Ivy League, not just Ivy Leaguers, but, you know, like, just, you know, anywhere in the world, just incredibly rich guys that didn't want to be embarrassed by, you know, a bunch of working class dudes that actually did that for a living. And that's kind of how I see WADA. You know, WADA's trying to protect, you know, the purity of whatever sport it is. And, you know, there's, you know, sports is a business like anything else. And last I checked, Daniel, you know, business is not, in any business, there's nothing clean about it. You know, it's, you know, every business is a dirty business, and that includes sports. And that's why I kind of, I understand, you know, part of the whole thing about performance enhancing drugs, but on the other hand, it's like, you know what? I just don't like the sanctimony of it. That's the part that gets me. You know, quit pretending.
No, I agree with you.
Sports,
and you know,
quit pretending that sports are pure and clean as driven snow. It's just not the case.
No. No, it's not. I will say this though. You know, I try to be as sanctimonious as possible, but I always lose out. So there's nothing I can do about that. But
well, yeah,
you know,
please,
all I can say. I promise you, that's already been thrown out the window long, long time ago. So that's over with. But cortisone shots are the most legal steroid there is in the world in the professional sports. So that's why Tony was able to get out there and at least practice. But you know, John, just to tell you this real quick, I don't know if you saw my report. I was actually, before this World Cup began, Fox Sports had their send-off party for their broadcasters going to Russia for the World Cup, and it was in New York City, and the greatest place to have it is at the Russian Tea Room. And I can tell you, John, there was no collusion at all.
I saw that. I saw that you were at the Russian Tea Room. Is that the first time you'd ever been? They actually let you in, Daniel?
I know. They actually let me in. I can't believe it. After all the years I'm from New York City and all the years – that I've always passed that famous red awning up and down West 57th Street. I finally went inside. Man, it is swanky as hell. It's just unreal what it was in there. It was really cool.
Did you steal any of the logo napkins from the men's room?
No, unfortunately, I couldn't get that. No, but you know what, though? I got a nice little gift bag from Fox Sports, and I'll tell you what it was. In my hand currently is the mini replica football of the Adidas Telstar World Cup ball. It has the World Cup logo for Russia 2018 on two panels, and the other two panels is the Adidas logo. And Mr. Jagu, I don't know if you are a fan of this little delicacy, but I got a nice little jar of caviar.
Ooh, very nice.
Yes.
So you got a goodie bag that
had a ball. I haven't opened it yet.
Caviar. Was there a shirt in there? I hope there was a shirt in there for you.
Unfortunately, no shirt.
It was.
It came in a nice little, like, you know, bag, that, like a tote bag, but it has the lining inside to keep the stuff cold and everything. It came with a little ice pack in it. You can put in the freezer, you know, over and over and over. So, living the high life for that one little day. One little day.
Well, I'll
take a picture of it and I'll send it to you.
Have you finished the caviar?
I haven't touched it yet, so I'm definitely going to try it out. I've never had caviar in my entire life. I was told it's like a lot of money, $400 worth in that little jar. Yes.
Yeah, well, it's going to be very salty.
Yes.
So you get yourself some nice crackers, get some creme. Don't get like sour, get some creme fraiche. Go to your fancy gourmet supermarket, get some creme fraiche. And you're going to want to dice up some onions. You're going to want to boil an egg. And then what you do is that you cut, once you have your hard-boiled egg, you peel it. You cut the egg whites and you take the yolk. And then you push the yolk through a strainer, like a real thin strainer. So you have the nice powdery yellow, you know, part of the yolk. And you do the same thing with the egg in that way. And then you enjoy you make a little. You know, like a little buffet, put the cream down and the caviar and the onion and the egg and et cetera, and then enjoy your caviar that way.
And I'm writing this all.
Eat it with your pinky up, for God's sake.
You got it.
You don't want to be a Philistine.
Definitely, I'm not going to be prudish about this. I'll definitely put the pinky out. But you know what, John? Listen, thanks again for coming on. I really do appreciate it. And we'll see what Mexico is going to do in their next group stage match this coming Saturday.
Yeah, the nerves will be back Saturday morning.
Yes, they will be. And next thing you know, the Fuero Osorio chants will be back on. No, I'm just joking.
Republic. It's funny because you say that. But, I mean seriously, I mean, Mexico gets a bad result over these next two games. That is the first thing right now they're talking about how Mexico is the greatest team in the world. You know, they get the one bad result, they'll go back to being the worst team in the world. It happened. I mean, I've seen
that's
it happen
right.
over and over and over again. So.
Oh, yeah.
All right,
no,
Daniel, thank you very much for letting me come
on. Those games too. No problem. Thanks for coming on, John. I appreciate it, and I'll talk to you again soon. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Thanks.
Cheers. John Jagoo, SoccerChronicles.com, the Cantina MX podcast. Of course, wanted to have him on with Dwayne Rollins and Michael Lewis when the United States, Mexico, Canada won the tri bid for the World Cup in 2026. Couldn't get him on live. I wanted to have him on, of course, to talk about that great result with Mexico and, of course, Mexico being part of the bid to win the World Cup 8 years down the road. So it's going to be interesting to watch. I have some time now. Second division standings, second division matches, USL games. Once again, hope the NASL does come back and we can see what's going to happen. Here we go right now. Tuesday, June 12th, Penn FC defeating Richmond Kickers. Final of 2-1. Wednesday, June 13th, 1-1 draw, Atlanta United 2, Charlotte Independence. North Carolina FC defeating Ottawa Fury 4-2. A 2-2 draw at FC Cincinnati hosting Bethlehem Steel. 3-2 victory as Swope Park Rangers defeats Real Monarchs. Fresno FC losing at home 1-0 to Sacramento Republic, and then Timbers 2 losing at home to Oklahoma City Energy by a final of 2-1. And then, of course, Phoenix Rising demolishing Vegas Lights 4-0. Saturday, June 16th, Pittsburgh Riverhounds 3-0 victory over Red Bulls 2. Toronto 2 losing at home to Indy 11 3-1. 1-1 draw, Charlotte Independence hosting the Charleston Battery. FC Cincinnati demolishing Richmond Kickers 4-0. 3-3 draw between Louisville City FC and Penn FC. 1-0 victory as Nashville Soccer Club defeating North Carolina FC 1-0. Oklahoma City Energy defeating Rio Grande Valley Toros 3-1. Real Monarchs on the road beating St. Louis FC 1-0. San Antonio FC defeating Sacramento Republic 1-0. 2-2 draw between Orange County SC and Reno 1868 FC. 3-0 Phoenix Rising defeating Tulsa Roughnecks. 4-1 Vegas Lights defeating Sounders 2. Colorado Springs Switchbacks defeating Timbers 2, 4-1. And then Fresno FC defeating Swope Park Rangers, 4-1. Those two games are on Sunday, June the 17th. And now we go over to the standings of both East and West conference standings right now. In first place, FC Cincinnati with 30 points. Second place, Louisville City FC with 24 points. Pittsburgh Riverhounds, they're tied for second with 24 points, so with Louisville City, but Pittsburgh has played one game more. That's why they're in third. Nashville SC in fourth place, 23 points. Charlotte Independence in fifth place with 22 points. Indy 11, 21 points. Charleston Battery, 21 points, but Indy 11 has one game in hand. Red Bulls 2 in eighth place, 20 points. The rest from 9th to 16th, Bethlehem Steel FC, Tampa Bay Rowdies, Penn FC, Ottawa Fury FC, North Carolina FC, Richmond Kickers, Atlanta United 2, and Toronto FC 2. They're in dead last with 2 points. Real Monarchs right now leading the points in the USL with 34 in first place in the Western Conference. Phoenix Rising FC in second with 31 points. Sacramento Republic in third place, 28 points. Portland Timbers 2 in fourth place, 26 points. Swope Park Rangers in fifth place with 25 points. It's kind of tight right now with the bottom five. Orange County SC in sixth place at 24 points. Reno 1868 in seventh place at 22 points. And then Colorado Springs Switchbacks in eighth place with 20 points. From ninth to last, San Antonio FC, St. Louis FC, Fresno FC, Las Vegas Lights FC, Oklahoma City Energy FC, LA Galaxy 2, Seattle Sounders FC 2, Rio Grande Valley FC, Tulsa Roughnecks with 14 matches played with 7 points. And the upcoming scores or should I say the upcoming schedule for the USL right now. And let's not forget we have U.S. Open Cup coming up between Nashville SC as they will take on Louisville City over in Louisville, Kentucky, as we take a look at the schedule coming up. The only match involving USL sides owned by the MLS sides, Bethlehem Steel FC hosting the New York Red Bulls 2 at Goodman Stadium at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Friday, June 22nd, Tampa Bay Rowdies hosting Penn FC. On Saturday, June the 23rd, Charleston Battery hosting Pittsburgh Riverhounds FC at MUSC Health Stadium. North Carolina FC hosting Louisville City. Salem Stadium at Wake Med Soccer Park. Richmond Kickers hosting Charlotte Independence at City Stadium. Oklahoma City Energy FC hosting LA Galaxy 2 at Taft Stadium. Rio Grande Valley FC hosting Phoenix Rising FC at HEB Park. San Antonio FC hosting Reno 1868 Toyota Field. Colorado Springs Switchbacks hosting Fresno FC at Widener Field. Orange County SC hosting Tulsa Roughnecks FC at the Champion Soccer Stadium at OC Great Park. Papa Murphy's Park is going to have Sacramento Republic hosting St. Louis FC. And then on the Sunday afternooners, 5 o'clock p.m., both games, Red Bulls 2 hosting Ottawa Fury FC at the Montclair State University Soccer Park. And Swope Park Rangers hosting Las Vegas Lights FC at Children's Mercy Park. That is your list of matches for this coming round in the United Soccer League second division standings and second division schedule. Well, Val, that is going to be it. And just real quick before I say goodnight, I'm very excited about this. I'm very happy about this. And all you can say is that it's great to have the World Cup return, not just to the United States, but coming back to North America and CONCACAF. I want to thank my guests tonight. I want to thank Glenn Crooks, broadcaster for New York City FC, the former Rutgers women's soccer head coach, and Mr. Michael Anderer of Blue City Radio, and of course, Mr. John Jagu, SoccerChronicles.com, and the Cantina MX podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. Join me this coming Friday, as we'll recap the fifth round of the Lamar Hunt U.S. Open Cup. No Red Bulls game so far. We'll have to wait for that on this coming Monday. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you very much for listening to me tonight. And as always, please enjoy your football. Thank you. Have a good night, everyone. Talk to you next time. Take care. And bye-bye for now.